second time in a row. And I came back and got off right off the plane, taught a class in one place, went somewhere else, taught a class somewhere else. And then that night they had me go into some kind of braai for all the deacons there to talk with me. And so we're talking, and I'm starting to lose it. I'm starting to lose it big time. And by the time we're eating dinner, my brain was in full shutdown mode. I literally couldn't even talk. And in fact, if you'd asked me my name, I think I might possibly have been able, maybe. And so I go to the line, I get some food, and then I just walk over into the corner by myself, sitting there kind of eating like this. Yeah. And the whole purpose of the meeting is for everybody to talk to me. So finally somebody came up and said, so is it time for you to go home? And I had to preach twice the next morning. Hey, man, it's awesome. All right, so Arminius. So he basically rejected monergism in favor of synergism, which is the belief that God's will and our will work together in our salvation. All right, neither is working apart from the other. So are you Arminian? I know I'm not Arminian. That's a joke. All right, I know I'm not Arminian. Are you Arminian? The answer is, I think I am. And so if you ever get charged with that, it's okay. You might say, I don't like labels, don't label me, if you want to say that. But, you know, just say, yeah, that's right. I do believe that God loves us enough to give us a choice, and that although there is heaven and hell ahead of us, that we have a role in deciding it. God is not the author of evil. Thank you very much for calling me an Arminian. Anyway, he didn't form a religious group, but his way of thinking became a religious group in Holland. Like I said, Holland was the first place to have true religious tolerance already in 1589, and this is a few years later than that. All right, and so they formed a group called the Remonstrants, and it really, really, really tested the idea of religious freedom in Holland, and many of them were arrested. A small number of them were even executed, but that was what they called religious freedom back then. But actually, the Remonstrant Church exists even today. So a sort of a very, very tiny remnant group of Christians who trace their lineage back to Arminius and his successors exists in Holland today. And they're the opposite of the Dutch Reformed Church. Now, some of the implications of Calvinism are very, very disturbing. Manifest destiny, right? You heard of manifest destiny? That's Calvinism. That's a political form of Calvinism, which means God has made us the ones who displace you guys. We're the new guys, you're not. That's kind of scary. All right, the idea of prevenient grace, which means that basically God kind of gives us a little piece of grace before he gives us full grace. Because we are fallen beings, and again, I'm not going to define that. I'm purposely not defining it. So on some level, our ability to choose freely is limited, right? Do you know anybody who's made it without sinning? I don't know of anybody. So we have this fleshly nature, which we cannot fully escape, that's for sure. And yet God's, again, this is not a biblical word, prevenient grace, gives us sufficient grace so that we can do some good. All right? But nobody's good, you know, capital G good. We can do some good, and we can choose. All right? God foreknows, but does not predetermine. And like I said, he claimed that that Calvinism made God the author of sin. By the way, the Restoration movement is not the only Arminian group, okay? Methodists are Arminian. And the original Baptists were Arminian. Okay, we'll talk about the general and particular Baptists. I don't know if we'll get that far today. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. But God's in control, so he'll decide if we do or don't. Okay, great. All right, so anyway, Arminius said this, the grace sufficient for salvation is conferred on the elect and on the non-elect. Got that? It says the grace sufficient for salvation is conferred on the elect and on the non-elect, that if they will, they may believe or not believe, may be saved or not be saved. I think we agree with that. So I say, yes, we are Arminian. There was the thing called the Synod, S-Y-N-O-D. It's like a council of Dort, which is short for the actual name of the town, Dortmund or whatever. So they had the Synod in which basically Arminius debated with Gomarus. And Arminius's group was dismissed. And they produced the Dort Confession, which is the confession of the Dutch Reformed Church. And like I said, when I was, somebody's trying to get me to work for this Christian school, I knew it was going to be Calvinist. They're all Calvinists. Either that or they're Catholic, pretty much. So there was this statement of faith, and they said, basically, I had to be willing to raise my right hand and say, yes, I agree and confer with the Dort Confession. All right. Churches which accept Arminian include Methodist, Restoration Movement, some Baptists, and some Pentecostals, and some independent churches. Independent churches are great for a postmodern period, but they're a little confusing to us moderns because we want everything to be very well defined, and they're not. All right, so a couple things we're not going to be covering in any kind of detail. We're not covering the Counter-Reformation. The principal agents in the Counter-Reformation were Jesuits and Dominicans. And so it was both a spiritual and a physical war to destroy Protestantism. And it resulted in a 30 years war. Now, I don't think we were justified in blaming the 30 years war on Catholics. But I do believe the Catholics were the initiators, the initial aggressors in that war. They were trying to conquer Protestant lands. The chief defender of Protestant power was the King of Sweden. But anyway, every single state in Europe got involved. And at some point, Protestant states were on the Catholic side. Catholic states were on the Protestant side. It's a mess. It's all politics. It has nothing to do with God. All right, but anyway, so there was both a physical and a spiritual battle. The Council of Trent, you'll read in the book about that. That's a number of doctrines that we associate with Catholicism were decided there at Trent. I mean, they were beliefs, but not, canons of the church. All right, not accepted dogma of the church. Yes. The other thing is the story of the creation of the English Bible, all right, which is a fascinating story. You can read about it. I'm not sure we need to discuss that here. The story of Tyndale, who wanted to create a Bible in English, and he proposed that in English. And the first answer was great, but then some people heard about it, said, no, in fact, we're going to kill you if you do. So he's forced to flee and went to Germany. He began his translation there. His opponents caught up with him there. So he went to Holland, where, again, the only place with official religious freedom was there. Unfortunately, the British and the Dutch were in a sort of allies. And so the British exercised sufficient power there. So basically a turncoat, sort of a Judas, talked Tyndale into coming out into the street to have a little conversation. The English arrested him, brought him to a court, condemned him, and executed him. All right, for sedition. For doing what? For translating the Bible into English. Hundreds and hundreds of words that we have in our English language come directly from his translation. And it's hard to imagine the number of words that we didn't have in the English language. There was no equivalent. And he could have used an English word, but often he created his own words. Tyndale and Shakespeare are the two most influential human beings that we know of, anyway, on the modern English language. All right. Anyway, his translation was not the best ever translation. All right, because it was basically just him and a couple other people, but mainly him. And some of these others, the Coverdale, Geneva, King James, etc., had committees. And so those are probably better translations. But really, to a large extent, they rather than go back to the Greek, what they did was they started with Tyndale's translation and the Greek and kind of and did a revision rather than a brand new translation. All right. And some of the Bibles were for different groups. For example, the Geneva Bible, obviously, was for Calvinists. All right. The Coverdale Bible, the Great Bible, I believe, was for Lutherans. And then the Douay Rheims Bible was for Catholics. It was not translated until 1589. So the Catholics didn't even have an official Bible for about 50 years. And then the Old Testament wasn't translated for Catholics until about 1620. So for almost 100 years, Catholics had to either not read the Bible at all, or they had to read a Protestant translation. Now, you would think there wouldn't be such a thing as a Protestant or a Congregationalist or a Baptist translation, but to some extent, that's what they were. Anyway, next is the English Protestant Reformation, an absolutely fascinating story. But I don't think you're going to learn a lot. There's no important theological concepts, not even any huge important church history concepts there, so read it in the book. King Henry VIII, what an interesting guy. I mean, he started the Reformation, but he couldn't have cared less. In fact, the bottom line is he was Catholic. He was totally Catholic. And he started this thing purely as a means to an end, which was to get rid of Catherine of Aragon and Mary Catherine Parr, and then later Anne Boleyn, and later whatever. And yet there were true reformers in there. Cranmer is one of them. It's a fascinating story. Almost all of these original reformers who carried out the original form and created the Book of Common Prayer and all that stuff, almost all of them were executed, including Cranmer. And if you go to the university there at Oxford, you see there's the street there and the little plaque and all the different people just hung or whatever, beheaded, whatever. The number of martyrdoms to defend the Reformation there in England were great numbers. Okay, that's a great story. Anyway, it produced a thing called the Book of Common Prayer. And again, the English Reformation was the least complete of all of them. So it's sort of like Catholic without the Pope. That's an overstatement, because the bottom line is it does have the idea of faith alone. And in fact, ultimately, there was a further revision during the time of the English Revolution, in which the Book of Common Prayer was made pretty similar to the Westminster Confession, which is the Presbyterian, totally Calvinist creed. So anyway, you probably don't care a whole lot about the Book of Common Prayer. You know, it's not really influencing your life. But that is the liturgy book for Episcopalian and Anglican. Okay, great. Oops. And then the story of John Knox and the Scottish Reformation. John Knox was not a terrifically original theologian, but his story is amazing. Incredible, the courage of this guy, the things he went through, the number of times he was arrested, threatened with execution, he never, ever backed down. He lived as a marked man for I don't know how many years, and he went right up to Mary, Queen of Scots, in her face, and he dared her to kill him. This guy was amazing.
Why didn't she?
The bottom line is she was afraid of him. She was kind of like, Jesus in Jerusalem. You know, public? I don't know. All right. Anyway, eventually she was overthrown, and she was later killed by Queen Elizabeth, as you know that story. But anyway, so John Knox, who brought about the Reformation, and his Reformation was a thoroughly Calvinist Reformation. And it led to what's known, they didn't call it the Presbyterian Church, it was the Scottish Church, Church of Scotland. We call it Presbyterian, and the reason is because it's based on elders. So there's, ultimately, there are three flavors of Christianity in England. there was Episcopalian, they call it Anglican. So what happened is that the Anglicans came to America, and believe me, it was an Episcopalian church. They just didn't call it that. And then so we kick out King George, right? So the King of England was head of the Church of England, the head of the Anglican Church, and we're not going to, you know, be in a church that's under the king that we just rebelled against. So instead of having the Archbishop of Canterbury as the actual head and the King of England as the nominal head, we're going to just have bishops. So Episcopalian means bishops. Episcopos, bishops. And Presbyterian means elders. Now, in the Bible, what's the difference between an elder and a bishop? They're basically two different functions of the same person, right? All right? Yes? Elder, overseer, and shepherd. The overseer is the elder, is the shepherd, all three. But but under Catholicism, the bishop was the head honcho over all these churches. Yes?
Is pastor included in that?
Pastor, elder. Pastor and shepherd literally mean the same thing, of course. All right? But pastor and shepherd are both translations of poema, the Greek word poema. And then there's presbyteros, which is translated as elder or presbyter. Okay, got it? And then there's the third one. I'm running out of mental energy, so I'm going to have trouble recalling certain words for the next hour. So presbyteros, poema, and the third one, the one that means overseer. Anyway, good. So anyway, a Presbyterian church is a church run by elders. So in other words, the elders in the church oversee the church. So there you have essentially local elderships. Okay, so they don't have the system of parishes and what's the thing, the level above a parish? That's what they have in England. So basically, in England, the priests do not have the power to do confirmation. The bishop has to do that. So the bishop is over the local priests. That's the Anglican system. And then you have a bunch of equal presbyters in the Presbyterian system. And the third kind was the independent churches. That was the Congregationalists. That's the Puritans. Where the Puritans said every congregation is fully autonomous and the leadership is chosen by the members of that autonomous church. So which is the correct one? A bishop having power over multiple churches, local elder having power, oversight over that church, or the members and full autonomy in the members choosing.
The second one,
I'm not sure we could say with an absolute prescriptive thing, but it's certainly closest to the New Testament pattern. Fair enough? So we're with the Presbyterians on that. Okay, another thing we're not doing here is we're not discussing the Reformation in France, which is another interesting story. So I'm just going to make a couple comments and move on. So what's interesting is in France, you have two competing powerful groups, and those are the Jansenists and the Jesuits. And the Jansenists, Pascal, you might have heard of Pascal. Pascal was a Jansenist. And these were Catholic Calvinists. In other words, they're Augustinians. Okay? They're Catholics who, under the influence of John Calvin, have gone back to Augustine, whereas the mainstream of Catholics are under, you know, Thomas Aquinas. And then you have the Jesuits, I would say to the left, right and left, I don't know how that applies. I would say the Jansenists are definitely the conservatives, no question about it. And the Jesuits are relatively the liberals. All right, and the Jesuits are kind of Arminian, if you will. The Jansenists are Calvinists. And then there's the middle-of-the-road Catholics. Got it? And so you had two kinds of Calvinists in France, the Jansenists and the Huguenots. And these are flat-out Reformed, you know, Reformed churches. They're under Calvin, they're under Beza, and they have their church councils sometimes even there in Switzerland. Okay, these guys, there's the Edict of Toleration, the Edict of Nantes, toleration of Huguenots, and it's complicated, and it's really not worth knowing so much about that. All right. But eventually Louis XVI, you know, backed off on that, and basically the Huguenots were forced to either convert or be killed or go overseas. Most of them went overseas, and France lost because there was a huge brain drain. The merchants, the best educated, the wealthiest people in France were these Huguenots. Those Calvinists, man, they're hard workers. If you can say something about Calvinists, they work hard. Greg and I are both really actually closet Calvinists because we work too hard. All right, so they were very wealthy, very successful. And so they kicked most of them out, and it impoverished France to a large extent. And then Molinism, all right, this is a Molinist, and this is philosophical Arminianism. Okay, so Molinist, he was a priest, he was a Catholic priest, but he was a Catholic priest who was basically forming a philosophical basis for Arminianism, for the idea of free will. All right, and Craig, what's his name? Not William Lane Craig, Plantinga, the most influential sort of evangelical theologians that are actually tend to move away from Calvinism. They tend to accept Molinism. Molinism is a very philosophically acceptable version of Arminianism. I'm not into Molinism, but you know, some of my friends think that's the best thing ever. Ah, whatever. All right, so that's what's happening in France. Okay, the Counter-Reformation. All right, great. There's a slide here. So there we go. Eliminated many medieval excesses, indulgences. So indulgences were completely eliminated, but the bottom line is there was some stuff in Catholicism that they have to say, yeah, I admit, that's pretty embarrassing. Remember I said the Catholic Church in 1517 was nowhere near as morally corrupt as it had been a couple hundred years before. Now, as far as riches, it was still very corrupt. But the honest truth is the Catholic Church has reformed itself to a pretty significant extent. Now, you look at the sexual abuse scandals, and they got a ways to go still. All right, so they did. But the Counter-Reformation wasn't primarily about reforming the church. It was primarily about defeating Protestantism. All right, many famous Catholic teachings were made official at that point. They officially said church tradition is equal in authority to the Bible. Now, the Catholics had believed that for like 1,300 years, but said officially something said by, let's say, I don't know, Origen or Irenaeus or Augustine or any of these guys, that has equal authority with what's said in the Bible. All right, that seems like not a great idea there. Anyway, condemned Luther as heretics. They confirmed work salvation. So again, if the Protestant Church says faith only salvation, and then what are the Catholics going to do? Naturally, you know, they're going to go for like works only salvation. Unfortunately, they confirmed the seven sacraments. Blah blah blah. So not a lot of important stuff for us there. Okay, the Second Protestant Reformation. All right. So to me, this is how I think about it. There were several attempted reformations before the Reformation, which didn't utterly fail, but failed mostly. And what are those earlier reformations before 1517? These not terribly successful reformations, which left virtually nobody, but, you know, No, before 1517. Starts with a W. Waldensians. All right. Starts with an H. Huss. Starts with a W also. Wycliffe. All right. So similarly, there were attempts to have a real Reformation, which returned, freedom of choice. All right, religious tolerance, that people get to choose what they believe. They're not forced to be a member of the church that is the church of their king. All right, the idea of religious freedom, religious tolerance. All right, and so there were attempts to do that. So the Anabaptists would be to the Second Reformation as the Hussites or the Wycliffeites would be to the First Reformation. So these were somewhat aborted attempts to bring out a Reformation of Catholicism, and Anabaptists would be a somewhat aborted attempt to go all the way, essentially, which is go back to the biblical idea of the church being made out of actual disciples and following the only the Bible as the actual authority, not going back as far as Augustine, but going back as far as Paul and Jesus. And this could only be successful either by escaping into the furthest wilderness and hanging on and trying to stay alive, which is what some of the Anabaptists did. Got that? Or by pushing a program of religious freedom. And here we go. So here is where religious tolerance was achieved, first in Holland, then Rhode Island. We may get that far today. Then Pennsylvania, I doubt we'll get to that today. Then England, then France, and then elsewhere. And once you have religious toleration, then you could be a Christian of conscience rather than a Christian of somebody told you what to do. So in principle, we have free will, but if you have a system that says you have to do this whether you like it or not, you'd have to, I guess, hide out or something like that. Okay, great. So let's talk about a couple of other groups. All right, and so basically these are things that happened either during this Second Reformation or just immediately before. All right, so as long as you have the magisterial Reformation, you still have Christendom, and you're still going to have a very, very limited number of choices, if you will. And those choices were, I think I listed them already, were Catholic. Except, of course, those didn't exist in Europe, but Coptic, Jacobite, Nestorian had been already wiped out, and then Eastern Orthodox, Catholic, and basically Lutheran and Calvinist. Those were your choices. All right, got it. But as we go into the 17th century, movements begin. And it gets to be a situation where, for example, in England, there were lots of choices. Now, is this good or bad to have these different choices?
I think that, in the time, I guess it was good. I'm going to go bad.
Okay. I don't know. I mean, to have choice, in other words, to have the opportunity to be a Christian as you believe you ought to be, seems like that's good. Yeah. But to have so many choices to choose from, it seems like, wouldn't it be better if there's just one thing to choose from? I'm gonna throw out something that maybe this is controversial, and maybe you won't agree, and maybe I'm not even right. But I believe, as of the year 2019, it's absolutely impossible to go back to having just one church.
Right.
And I would argue I'm not even convinced it's even desirable anymore. All right, because the bottom line is, there are doctrines that are not salvation issues that people are going to differ over, and I'm not sure they can fellowship together. So can you fellowship under one leadership with a charismatic? I'm not sure you can do it. Now, it sounds kind of bad. It sounds like I'm going fully for postmodernism to say different flavors may not be all bad. You know what I'm saying? But maybe a certain range of flavors may not be all bad.
Might not kill us.
So how do we reconcile that, though, with Paul's call to unity, you know, the one church, one God, one baptism, you know?
I know, but first of all, let's be practical. That ain't going to happen.
Right.
I mean...
Well, and God's a diverse God, too.
What's that? Sorry.
He's a diverse God, too.
Well, right. Now, first of all, you should note that in the first, second, and third century, the amount of diversity in that church is ridiculous. But the theological diversity, the diversity of practice and belief was really broad. And it was only when these heretics started raising all these issues that the leadership was forced to start saying, no, that's not going to be accepted anymore. Nope, that's not going to be accepted anymore. Nope, that's not going to be accepted anymore. So, I mean, the bottom line is, I don't know how to be one anymore. It's kind of sad. It's confusing. But I think maybe in our heart, in our mind, in our attitude, that we are going to fellowship to the extent we can with people who are real disciples. And we're going to do mercy first, judgment second, and go from there. But I'm going to take your question or comment in a second term. The bottom line is, we're not going to go back to that. And a certain amount of variety may not be all bad, because you know it's possible that one flavor maybe a place where this person could be saved, whereas that one they couldn't. Now, but as I say that, I feel like I'm probably getting in trouble on some level. So, go ahead, Turnwell.
I would agree with that. I mean, I know churches that have multiple services. Like they'll have an early morning service for the older folks who like to get up earlier and have more traditional or quieter, softer songs sung. They'll have a band and louder music.
Uh-huh. Right. But if you have house churches, obviously you're not going to be able to do that, right? So you're going to have one house church that's like this and another house church that's like that. They're not going to have both flavors, right? Greg?
So I'm on a task force right now. We're writing a paper on women's roles. Let me pose this question. What if I'm a church that only lets men speak? What if some church in our fellowship chooses to let women speak also?
Speak how, though?
Well, that's the point.
Under the headship of Jesus and under the headship of a male, but preach.
Preach. Yes.
So you're asking what we think of that?
I'm saying if that were the case, because of disputable issues, isn't that an argument for what John's saying, that there's going to have to be some variety if we're going to...
Even in our own fellowship, maybe even
fellowship
in the same city.
Maybe we won't even be one church, but they'll still be disciples. Mm-hmm. Because you can't say they're not disciples anymore. Right?
And that's already true, because there's saved people that don't go to our church. Yeah. Wasn't it nice when you're unchristian, everything was so simple?
Yeah,
plus,
right?
You're in a church that made it appear as if it is all simple.
You're becoming teachers, so you got to wrestle with it.
So, my thinking is more along the lines of that world. Like, I tend to lean towards, you know, I look at the New Testament, I look at, you know, the possibility of Judea and Romans, like her being an apostle. You know, so my thinking is that way. But however, I just wonder the initial intent. Right, when Jesus went up to heaven, either he knew this was going to happen, and so...
Well, I don't know if Jesus did, because Jesus, his omniscience was purposely self-limited. Fair. So how about the Father?
Yes, the Father. Either he knew this was going to happen, and it was predestined.
It was foreknown.
Or there was an intent of one church, one faith, one baptism, and then we can't... Because of our nature, because of our fallen world, we can't
in
that.
Does that reconcile with Romans 14, though, as far as accept one another?
While you're doing that, I would argue there's three different definitions of the word church. All right? And I believe two of them are biblical and one is reality. One definition of church is a group of Christians who agree to meet together under a local leadership. Another definition of church is this esoteric thing for which Jesus died. All right? And the third definition of church is a group of Christians who fellowship with one another one way or another. Of course, that third one is not in the Bible, but it's certainly reality today. So when he said it's one church, what was he which of those things was he talking about? I believe he's talking about this one universal thing.
Yeah.
All right, and that thing may have more than one form in this world. And the question is, are we going to learn to be able to fellowship with people that don't agree with us on every point? And so as our church moves forward, we're going to have to find unity within diversity rather than unity within uniformity. And the question is, how far is that diversity going to be able to go? Because honest truth is, there's going to be somebody going a distance where bottom line is, in order to accept them, that's going to create more trouble than it's worth. So they're probably... Not that we're condemning them to hell, but probably saying, you know what? Maybe you need to swim in a different pond for now. Otherwise, our organization will fall apart and really can't do anything at all. So these are hard questions. Stuff that, don't even bring these up to your young Christians. Don't even bring it up. Don't talk to them about it. Don't do that. But I would say your generation is going to have to deal with this more than our generation.
Yeah.
And, but you got people like Greg, who are thinking wisely about things and trying to anticipate how we can become a bit more flexible, a bit more open to diversity. And then we need the teachers, to some extent, to help give, sort of maybe help find the range within which we probably can be comfortable. And then, you know what's going to happen? People are going to push the edge of that, and then stuff's going to happen.
Yeah.
And so that's what I'm saying. I think the idea of one worldwide fellowship is maybe not even exactly what Jesus was talking about, although it certainly appeared to be that. In fact, that's what it was for about 300 years. It's really what it was.
Right.
But we can't put that genie back in the bottle.
Right.
It try as you might, it's not going to happen even if you want to. And at this point in the year 2019, I'm not even sure it's even completely desirable. Okay, because the bottom line is there's people that probably we can't help because of who we are. Somebody else can. For example, I would say charismatic groups, which they do some pretty bizarre stuff that I don't agree with at all. But the bottom line is they're saving some people that we're not helping at all right now. So, all right, great. This is a very fun and interesting discussion. And church history does shine light on this. That's one of the reasons we study church history. So we get it, so we don't have to be stupid about it, as we tend to be. All right, so let's talk about the Puritans. All right, don't even look at the screen. When you hear Puritans, what do you think about?
Crucible.
Okay, but just give me an adjective.
Flowers.
An adjective.
Oh, an adjective.
Prude.
Prude, good.
Tight.
Uptight. Plain, boring, conservative. That is not a fair stereotype of the Puritans, I'll tell you that right now. Now, it's not without truth. It's not without truth, okay? Because you're thinking of the Massachusetts Bay Colony especially. All right, yeah. But, you know, there is some truth to that, but it is really quite exaggerated. It is an unfair characterization of the Puritans in general. All right, but I'm telling you, these guys are some pretty strong, convicted Christians. That's for sure. And they showed great conviction, great willingness to be persecuted. The problem is when they took control, man, you know, because they were not in control and they were crying out for religious freedom. They got control and man, they stole everybody's religious freedom in about 2 seconds. What hypocrites. But that wasn't all Puritans. That was just certain ones, like in Massachusetts, for example. All right, so the bottom line is we have the English Protestant Reformation. But the English Protestant Reformation included things like having incense censers and priests with all these robes and Man, there was so much Catholicism, and they were still kneeling. I was Episcopalian growing up. We kneeled and you know, and genuflecting, and you know, it's almost like Protestant, almost like Catholicism without the Pope. Not in theology, but in practice. So there were many in England who found that to be horrifying. They wanted to be four walls in a sermon. Those are the Puritans. They did not call themselves Puritans. They were called that, you know, those Puritans. So their name kind of goes along with the stereotype. That stereotype has a limited validity, quite limited, but it's not, it has no validity. All right? Anyway, so the bottom line is they became dissenting churches. From about 1560 till about 1610, the Puritans almost only worked within the Anglican Church. And they were very, very patient. We promise, we promise, we promise. But then what happened is there was a Catholic reaction in England, and then so the Episcopalian Church moved radically back towards Catholicism, and then some of these Puritans said, "Never mind, we're going to form our own church." So that's what happened. All right. And this, remember, I said three kinds of church, which is Episcopalian, Presbyterian, or Independent. So the Puritans, for obvious reasons, which is they're trying to not be part of the Episcopalian Church, or Anglican Church, they were strong advocates of congregational autonomy. In fact, the Puritans, is there a Puritan church today? No. Well, yes, there is. It's called the Congregationalist Church. Now, those are only in New England and New York and a few places. This is the most washed out liberal, you know. The idea that the Congregationalist Church of today goes back to the Puritans, that'll drive you crazy if you think about it. But I grew up in New England, and every town had a Congregationalist Church. They're kind of like the United Methodists. They're kind of way out there liberal. You know, they don't really stand for much of anything, but they still have congregational autonomy. They elect their minister. There's no, hierarchy that ordains. They don't have ordination of priests, that kind of stuff. Okay, got it? So your three types are bishop, elder, or independent, Puritan. Okay? The Puritans became so large in England that eventually they kicked out the king of England. In fact, they executed him, King Charles. They arrested him and executed him. Now, the more famous version of this is in the French Revolution, right? 1689, storming the Bastille. 1793, they killed King Louis the 16th. But England had gone through that, you know, 150 years before. So the English Revolution was the Puritan Revolution. Basically, what happened is Parliament seceded from the king. And they had this huge civil war. And who won? Parliament won. And who was their leader? Oliver Cromwell. Well, and Oliver Cromwell was a Puritan. Now, Oliver Cromwell was a strong supporter of religious freedom. But the problem is, he was Calvinist. And how can a Calvinist, you know, in the 17th century be a supporter of religious freedom? So most of his friends didn't agree with him. And so the Puritan government was quite intolerant of Catholics and somewhat tolerant of the Anglican Church and intolerant of Quakers and others. Okay, got it? So Oliver Cromwell. Now, they had this, the synod, and they came up with the Westminster Confession. The Westminster Confession is the confession that's now used by the Presbyterian Church. So what was happening is that this big synod where we're going to come up with, this is the official Christianity of England today. Got it? But who showed up is Cromwell's people. And they all are going to have independent churches. They're going to be Congregationalists. But the problem is the Presbyterians comes. The English Revolution was supported by the Presbyterians. And the Presbyterians say, hey, we ain't going there. So what they did was they sort of stole the convention, and they made the official decision was to be Presbyterian. That's all confusing, but all right, that's boring. I better stop talking about it. To me, this is interesting, but for you, it's probably boring. Anyway, by about 1670, the Puritan Revolution was ended. Puritanism in England ended. There were virtually no Puritans left. Well, you've heard of Pilgrim's Progress, all right? So these were, there were some, Milton, Paradise Lost, Paradise Gained, as he was a Puritan. Pilgrim's Progress, author Pilgrim's Progress, this is in my book.
Jim Bunyan.
Yeah, Bunyan. These guys were Puritans in the 1660s, 1670s. They're all in jail. They're being, you know, because they lost, and King James came back in, King James II. And anyway, it's politics. So, but on the other hand, Puritanism did survive in Massachusetts. By the way, the Pilgrims were not Puritans. The Pilgrims were not Puritans. They were Brownians. And Brownians were the predecessors of the Baptists. All right, the Puritans were this really, really obscure sect that wasn't in England, it was in Holland. They did not have religious freedom in England. So if you wanted to practice a very radical, biblical kind of Christianity, you fled from England, you went to Holland. They weren't Puritans. They were Brownians, whatever that is. Read my book. All right. But what happened is the second expedition. So the Mayflower, those were Pilgrims. But then the Massachusetts colony and the Massachusetts whatever thing, the big Massachusetts, I don't know, their political, that was Puritan. So the next set of ships was Puritans, and they just took over. Now, the big difference between a Pilgrim and a Puritan, I don't know, probably wear the same silly hats or whatever. I'm not too worried about it, but just so you know, the Pilgrims were not Puritans, but the Puritans took over within like 10 years of Plymouth Rock. The Puritans were there, and Winthrop, that guy, that governor, he was a Puritan. And basically, they created a pure Puritan colony. And, you know, what about religious freedom? Because, you know, when you're in England, you're saying we should have religious freedom. You're saying, who are you to tell us how to worship? You come here and we say, well, we're going to tell you how to worship. Their response was, there's a lot of land here. I mean, there's Connecticut, there's New York, Pennsylvania. Yeah, it was, to some extent, it was true. You know, it's a semi-valid argument because Christendom has not been defeated yet, so we'll just have little mini Christendoms. So the Catholics, they go to Maryland. The Baptists, they go to Georgia. You know, that kind of stuff. That's, you know, the Methodists go to North Carolina. That was their idea. And by the way, the Anglicans go to Virginia for sure. That was very Anglican. All right. So that was kind of the mindset then. But by around 1700, the Puritan Revolution had ended in Massachusetts as well. And Massachusetts became a polyglot, and basically religious tolerance was, by about 1700, religious tolerance was everywhere in America. And that's why the center of gravity of Christianity moved to America. The center of gravity of Christianity in the early part of the Renaissance was Italy. From Italy it moved to Germany. From Germany it moved to England. And from England it moved to America. Well, guess what, folks? It moved away from America. Mm-hmm. The center of gravity of Christian activity now is in Africa. Mm. And to a lesser extent in China and Korea. We are no longer the place it's happening. We are convinced we're still the place where it's happening. And we're wrong. All right? So where are new Christian developments going to be happening? They're going to be happening in Africa or maybe in Central America, where people are still getting converted. You know what I'm saying? So, anyway. Robert gave a talk like this a couple days ago. Where was I? I've been so many places lately, I don't even know where I was. But
the hackathon.
That was that. All right. The hackathon. All right. So, let me see. How am I doing here? I think I can go another. Yeah, I can still go about another 20, 30 minutes here. Let's learn about the Baptists. You're going to be surprised. What about the Baptists? Now, who do we associate with Lutheranism?
Martin Luther.
Oh, very good. Who do we associate with Calvinism?
Calvin.
Or Zwingli. All right, who do we associate with Anabaptist? All right. So, since the Baptist church was really simply a new Anabaptism, it was virtually exactly the same thing. All right? Since it was, shouldn't be too surprising, there's no particular leader. Okay? It shouldn't be too surprising that there wasn't. The person who's given credit for starting the Baptist movement is John Smith in 1609, but the problem is he died in like 1611, so you didn't get a whole lot going there. All right, and there's other people's names. This guy, John Lamb, has been mentioned. The bottom line is it's hard to associate a name with the Baptist movement. So that's why people don't even study the history of the Baptist church, because it's sort of undefined. But I'm telling you, the Baptist movement was as exciting as the Anabaptist movement. Except we just don't know about it, which is strange. All right? So there's no Huss, Luther, Zwingli, or Calvin. This movement was a back to the Bible movement. They did not call themselves Baptists. You know what they called themselves? Church of Christ. So it's funny because a few years ago, somebody in the teacher group passed around this article. Did you read about the Church of Christ in England in 1600? Yeah, I thought the Church of Christ started, you know, with the Campbells in the 19th century. But I found out, no. It was in the early 17th century. Look, the story, the Churches of Christ. No, that's the Baptist Church. They just didn't know. They just confused over the name. Because who do you think called them Baptists? Not people outside. It's people baptized. So they could call us the Baptist Church, couldn't they? Except that name's already taken. Luckily for us, because they'd probably call us Baptists. All right? So that's what they were. So the bottom line is, the Baptists were us, or like what we hope we are, anyway. What we like to think that we are in the 17th century. All right, whereas the Restoration Movement is us in the 19th century. And the Anabaptists is us, we like to think anyway, in the 16th century. All right, so this movement came almost exactly 100 years after the First Reformation, and it is indeed part of the Second Reformation. This flowering of a vast number of very interesting groups, very diverse groups, and which are beginning to express all the different varieties of Christianity, which may even be legitimate. I mean, you get to decide. Okay, maybe, maybe not. Okay, there's good and bad here. So anyway, the level of persecution, thousands were killed. If you read Fox's Book of Martyrs, you heard of Fox's Book of Martyrs? A lot of those guys are Baptists. A lot of them are Baptists. Okay. So they formed Churches of Christ. So, by the way, it started in Holland. The Baptist Church started in Holland. It wasn't called the Baptist Church. But I'm telling you, this guy, John Smith, what a boring name. John Smith, he should have something. All right, anyway, he was living in Holland. But that's because that's where the dissenters went. The dissenters either lived in total hiding in England, or they'd go over to Holland where they could do their own thing. So what they'd do is they'd go to Holland, they'd form a church, get a group, and then sort of migrate back to England is what happened. So that's what happened, and they started to form these churches. And these churches didn't have a particular creed. They were just, their creed was the Bible. That was their only creed. And what they're trying to do was take Christianity back to its primitive roots and just be Christians and Christians only. And we're not going to have a creed. We're going to be more or less independent churches. We may have associations, but we're not going to have this head office. We're going to be pacifists. We're going to, practice righteousness as well as correct doctrine. Sound familiar?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, the early Baptist church was us. And they even used the same name that we use, more or less, although we use different names. Now, it turns out there were two flavors. Kind of a theme here, two flavors. The original Baptists were general Baptists. And they are Arminian. And then there were particular Baptists. I don't know, which name would you rather have, general or particular Baptist? I mean, if you had to have a name. General, particular, general, particular. By the way, they didn't call themselves general Baptists and particular Baptists. 200 years later, we call them that. And the fact is, these guys fellowship with each other quite a bit. It's kind of like what Greg is describing. We have two rather strikingly, we have a rather strikingly large difference on a fundamental belief, and yet people passed back and forth. They fellowship with each other. They gradually diverged to form separate groups, but, there's a fair amount of back and forth here. So, I don't know if you had to pick, which would you pick, general or particular?
General.
All right, good. So that's the right choice. That's the correct choice, because then you'd be an Arminian, and you believe that a God kind of works with us. You have prevenient grace. You believe that God is kind of working with us rather than saying, you, heaven, you, hell, like 98% hell, heaven. All right, so the bottom line is these guys were Calvinists. And you have to understand, almost everybody was Calvinist. You got your wimpy Anglicans who barely even, they just go to church just because they're supposed to, and, hardly any conviction at all. But the people with conviction generally were Calvinists, right? This is during the time of the English Revolution, right? Puritans. So a lot of these people who said, no, we're not even going to be Puritans. Remember, Puritans tried their very, 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 very best to stay within the Anglican Church. These guys had no interest, no way they're ever going to stay within the Anglican Church, because they're trying to establish a church according to the pattern of the Bible and the Bible only. But they're immersed in a Calvinistic, the committed believers are all Calvinists. So eventually you had Calvinist Baptist churches, and there you go. The Calvinist ones, those are called particular because God's election is particular. Other people say his election is general, like Jacob Arminius, right? Basically. All right. Now, why didn't these people call themselves Anabaptists? What was the difference between these guys and Anabaptists? It's like the difference between soul and spirit, joints and marrow. So why weren't they Anabaptists? Because the name Anabaptist was that had a terrible reputation. Any name even remotely connected in any way whatsoever with Anabaptism was anathema. Were these guys aware of the Anabaptists? Of course they were. Did they read some of their stuff? Yes, they did. But did they want to be associated with them? No way. You'd think they would. I mean, your brother or sister. But by this time, these Anabaptist groups are very isolated, kind of out away. So, whereas these guys are totally evangelizing. They are evangelism machines. Churches popping up everywhere. Yeah. Yeah.
So what's the difference in their beliefs and our beliefs? Because I feel like Baptist churches nowadays, they don't actually teach baptism.
Well, you got to look at the history of Baptist. All right. Now, which kind became the general? Which kind became the Baptist churches in America primarily? What do you think? It's not too hard to figure out, right? Right there. Now, the first Baptist churches in America were general Baptists, but those generally were in the North. And the Baptist churches that were planted in the South tended to be particular Baptists. Well, for example, the Southern Baptists. All right? And by the way, remember, one of the tendencies of restoration rather than Reformation groups, which is why we might want to ask ourselves, are we a Reformation or a restoration? Now, the average member is not going to get the distinction, but you might want to kind of in your head ask, what are we? If we are anything, what are we? Are we trying to reform something that exists? Or are we trying to restore something original?
Restore.
That's certainly what we think we are.
Yeah.
That's certainly what we say we are. I'll tell you right now, Alexander Campbell and Barton Stone never used that word at all. They called themselves a reformation, just so you know. All right? But if you are a restorationist, you will splinter. And the Baptists are a perfect example. By about 1700, there were so many different flavors of Baptists. There were Seventh-day Baptists. I mean, there's a list, and I can't remember them all. There were Seventh-day Baptists. There were Millennial Baptists, and there were blah, blah, blah Baptists, and there were blah, blah, blah. And how many different Baptist groups are there in America today? So the Baptists are saying, just forget the whole thing and becoming independent churches. Most independent churches are former Baptists. Most. Not all, but most. And so really, the heart of the evangelical movement, essentially, is Baptist. Okay, got it? So anyway, that's what happened. There's some really encouraging, inspiring stories. But anyway, so around 1610, 1620, 1630, hundreds of Baptist churches are rising. They did not immerse initially. A good reason that they weren't called Baptists originally, all right? So they kind of restored the teaching on baptism. That's in the book. I mean, it's somewhere around 1619, is very soon after. They were baptizing, but they weren't associated. Anyway, it's complicated. So anyway, by the year 1700, there were 130 particular Baptists and 115 general Baptist churches in England. Now, if you meet an English Baptist, that's one church. If you meet an English Baptist, they are going to be general Baptists. Now, it's not like the Baptist church is huge in England, right? You know, have you ever met an English Baptist? I've met like one or two. But the Baptist church in England is primarily Arminian. And there are particular Baptists in England, but they're rare. All right? And in the year 1700, it was like 50-50. By the early to mid-1700s, the Baptists weren't reaching out very much. That's kind of what happens to restorationist / Anabaptist kind of groups. Luckily, they turned around in America, and in the 1800s, man, they blew it out. I mean, and you know what happened to the Baptists? The largest group in America. Well, it was, other than Catholic. But I bet that probably Pentecostals passed out Baptist by now. I don't know if they have or not. And worldwide, they're going to pass out everybody, including the Catholic Church, within a few years, probably. But anyway. All right, I'm going on and on. The next group is the Quakers, and I think let's stop before we do the Quakers because it's probably 5:30 now. Is it? Okay, maybe I'll do the Quakers. Anyway, so as with many restorationist groups, they splintered into many, many different groups. You can look, you can read about them in the book. You know, it's all right. Now, there's a really well-known Baptist. His name is Roger Williams. Roger Williams comes to America, and he comes to Massachusetts. And what form of Christianity was there in Massachusetts Bay Colony? Puritans. And he had no interest in being a Puritan. First of all, he was Arminian. Second of all, he did not want to fellowship with the Anglican Church. He says, no, I'm a Christian. I'm not an Anglican. I'm a Christian. So basically said, I'm going to form my own church. And they said, if you do that, we're going to kill you, literally. So he left, and he went to Rhode Island. He was a true revolutionary, and he started the first Baptist colony, the only one for about 50 years, which was Rhode Island. And so in Rhode Island, he established religious toleration. In fact, Jews went to Rhode Island. Catholics went to Rhode Island. Quakers went to Rhode Island. Now, the problem with Rhode Island is it's kind of limited. So about 50 years later, all these dissenters and all this really cool sort of mix of all kinds of groups, they went instead to Pennsylvania. All right, and we're not there yet. So what happens then is you have the Baptists in Rhode Island, but by the late 1630s. Do I have the year here? I don't have it. It's late 1630s, like 1638, something like that, which is, what, 20 years after Plymouth Rock? Not even? Okay. So And the Baptist church group rather slowly, because there was not religious tolerance in America except in Rhode Island. But eventually you have Baptist churches in New Jersey and in Georgia, here and there. Okay, got it? But for reasons of acts and whatever, the bottom line is the flavor of baptism that predominated in the South, in Georgia, in South Carolina, was definitely particular Baptist. Okay? And that's where Baptists took off in the 1800s. They remained this tiny, tiny group. If you graph Baptists in America, it's going to be like this. And then, whoom! That was until the 19th century. And at that point, the Baptists in America became, you know, I'm sure, way, way over 95%, maybe over 98% particular Baptists. So that's why I said earlier, Baptists are Calvinists. But I think I might have said most of them. All right, so we'll do the Quakers. Let's do one more group. All right. George Fox. I like George Fox. Never met the guy. I actually went. I took a class at George Fox University, which is there in in Oregon, not too far from Portland, maybe an hour and a half away. All right, George Fox, 1624 to 1691. He lived to see religious tolerance in England. Lucky guy. Why should any man have power over any other man's faith, seeing that Christ himself is the author of it? All right, this is George Fox. George Fox was a very... he had amazingly, amazingly strong convictions in an amazingly open-minded mind. It's a very, very unusual combination. A guy with the strongest convictions, the strongest faith. You know, the guy was radical. He risked his life I don't know how many times. And yet he was amazingly open-minded, probably too open-minded, actually. All right? So, why should any man have power over any other man's faith, seeing that Christ himself is the author of it? So he's arguing for religious tolerance and religious freedom, which is what the minority group, I guess, always does, you know, until they get power, then you find out how sincere it was. In the case of Puritans, not so sincere. I'm pretty sure if Quakers took power, they would still have that attitude, and I know that for a fact, because they did. It's called Pennsylvania. Anyway, Now, George Fox grew up in Puritan Christianity. You have to understand, Puritan Christianity in the early mid-1600s, it was all about fire and brimstone. Another thing is, this whole idea is that you had to have a proof of your salvation, a conversion experience, and it was all about, you know, predestination, you know, and God has chosen you already and there's nothing you can do about it. The bottom line is you have a 2-hour boring sermon that's really just blah, 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 blah. No heart, no soul. The Puritan church, like the Lutheran church, was totally, totally up here, almost nothing down here. And George Fox, if nothing else, he was down here. You know who he's like? He's like Francis of Assisi. I'm telling you, George Fox is the Francis of Assisi of the 17th century. Remember Francis? This nature-loving, Jesus-loving monk, you know, attracted to the poor, to the common person. George Fox. George Fox is a beautiful soul, but a troubled soul. He had deep bouts of depression, probably even worse than Martin Luther. All right, so like Francis of Assisi, a lover of nature, his Christianity is very based on emotion, on feelings, struggle with depression. He started a church based on sentiment and feeling rather than doctrine and intellect. What a kind of a new idea. All right, he would be kind of like the postmodern church compared to the modern church. The modern church is based on doctrine and facts and necessary demonstrations. The modern church is based on experience, and you know your religion is worship is more about experience. You know, sermons, they're okay, but I want to have an experience. So worship is more strongly emphasized than preaching in the postmodern church. I'm not saying good or bad. I'm just saying what it is, okay? Or if not, then it's not a postmodern church, in which case postmoderns probably aren't going to come there. So we might have to adapt. Anyway, I digress. So George Fox then, to him, Christianity was about meditating on God. It's about just reading the Bible and just thinking about it and not worrying about all these creeds and all these doctrines. The Quakers, you want to explain the Quaker church, is a church with no creed. It's a church with no doctrine. Isn't that strange? Could there be a church with no doctrine? Yes, it's called the Quaker church. And I was reading about them in these books, and I thought, that can't be. So then I went to there's two major Quaker groups, there's two main ones, a conservative that are kind of evangelical, and this so out there liberal ones, it's like, are they Christian at all? You know what they have in common? They have no doctrine. Because every church has a statement of faith, right? So you go to their website, so their statement of faith is, just we believe in Jesus, and we just want to help people experience Jesus and know Jesus. It's kind of hard to argue with that. But then again, probably there's certain doctrines that maybe we should, you know, maybe hold on to. But I'm telling you, the postmodern age would be comfortable with the sort of the general milieu of the Quaker church, except they're just not very common anymore. So anyway, so what happened was he had this this crisis. Seems like a common theme here. And so at the age of like 16, he left home and just wandered for months, years, just trying to find the truth. And so he would sleep in haystacks in the open, just whatever, trying to find just enough food to survive. Kind of strange, a vagabond. But eventually he became sort of like the ascetics back in the early church. And people started saying, do you see this guy? Wow, how strange. But listen to him. Listen how spiritual he is. Our church, the ministers in our church, they're about as spiritual as a piece of bread. They're about as spiritual as a rock. And this guy, he doesn't even go to church and listen to how deep his connection is with God. What's he believe? I don't know, but he believes in Jesus. And so this society that we call Friends today developed. He called them Children of the Light. Now, I don't think we're going to be a Quaker, but you know what? I think there's a lot about Quakerism that's attractive. And I think we could kind of study them and learn about them and kind of, you know, incorporate some Quaker-like approaches to how we do Christianity. If we could combine the spirit of George Fox with a church that hasn't thrown out all doctrine, I think that'd actually be a pretty good thing. So anyway, this group called Friends, and they had their conventicles. Their worship is very, very spontaneous. You know what? One thing they have a lot in their worship? Silence. They'll have like 10 minutes where they're just silent. Strange. Now, their worship was not in churches. They weren't welcome in churches. In some cases, they were. Apparently, George Fox, he had this stare. You know, people just didn't want to look at him because he had this stare. You know, kind of like a Jesus stare. You know, and so people who were not into being godly, they just couldn't look the dude in the eye. They just couldn't do it. He just had that look of a guy who was just so close to God. Now, it could have all been fake, I guess, but I just don't see how it could be. I really don't see it. This guy seemed to have quite the connection. So he stressed religious experience and holiness over doctrine and dogma and creed. In England in the 17th century, I have to say, that's a pretty good thing. All right. They had women preachers. He said, the qualification for preaching is having the Holy Spirit, not having a degree, not even having an MRE. Bottom line is, if you had a heart for God, a Jesus-like spirit, and evidence of the Holy Spirit working in your life, you could preach. So they had women preachers. Can you imagine that? Think of the Puritans as being kind of, sort of, in a way, a little bit like the Charismatics of the 17th century. In fact, why do you think they're called Quakers? Now, George Fox said, there was some quote from somebody who said, quaking in the Lord, or something. No, no, it's because they would quake. So in their worship services, they start, during the moments of silence or whatever. So apparently they'd start kind of, you know, doing charismatic kinds of stuff that, you know, we were pretty uncomfortable with. Because, you know, we Church of Christ, we want to know what's the doctrine, what's the scripture, you know, that kind of stuff. Which, there's a lot to be said for that. But you know what? I think we've minimized experience. We've minimized contemplation, mysticism, these other things, which I think we might want to, you know, add in just a little bit of that stuff back in. Get a more holistic? Is that a... holistic. I don't like the word holistic. Because I'm a modern. I'm not a postmodern. I don't like holistic. But, you know, you guys like holistic, so I'm going to use that word. So kind of a holistic Christianity. All right? The qualifications for preaching was being filled with the Holy Spirit, not training at a seminary. They were the charismatics of the 17th century. Fox was persecuted. He spent more time in jail than he did free. Constantly being beaten. And the thing is, he refused to show respect to authority. He just, reject all authority. You know, it's kind of the total utter rebel. So he would not take his hat off for anybody. And I'm telling you, in the England of the 17th century, if you wouldn't take your hat off for the judge, jail. He befriended Oliver Cromwell. And he did the stare down with Oliver Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell was like, man, this guy's a man of God. Don't persecute the Quakers. But they did anyway. And tens of thousands were thrown in jail. Thousands died in prison. Very few were actually executed, but hundreds, if not thousands, died in jail. All right? And Fox nearly died in jail multiple times. All right? He was the first preacher from England to come to America. He had this huge tour. He toured from Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey, Virginia, North Carolina, South Carolina, and he preached to the Indians, to the Native Americans. He wanted to convert them. He didn't have much luck, but he sure tried. Anyway, I could say a little bit more about the Quakers, but that's good enough, and I'm getting tired, and I only got about 45 minutes of sleep last night. So let's just say we're going to end 25 minutes early because we didn't take enough breaks.
Did George die of natural causes?
He did. He died in 1691. He lived to be about 70 years old, I think. Almost 67. He died a peaceful death. His friend, I didn't mention Penn, you know, William Penn. He kind of carried Quakerism to America. But we're stopping there.
Prince College in Wichita, Kansas.
There we go. William Penn, King Charles II. He was a smart guy, man. He's very rich. He basically bought Pennsylvania.
Penn's Woods. Yep. John, really quick, was Calvinism the ones where they thought a sign that you were predestined to go to heaven is if you got money here on earth and if you were wealthy?
John Calvin would not agree with that at all. Are you kidding? Are there Calvinists? Are you asking whether the prosperity gospel is common amongst Calvinists? Yes. Yes. But please don't accuse Calvin of that.
But is there a certain religion that was kind of their bread and butter?
Yeah, it's called America in the 20th century, but... But before that, I don't think that flavor existed.
But there was, okay. Wasn't there something though, like that was the seal of your selection was?
I think I was taught that somewhere.
Yeah.
Was what?
That you lived a blessed life. That you had
lots of money.
Wealth or favor with people.
I would say this: the Calvinists were not embarrassed of becoming rich, not at all. And you know, and. In many ways, they were the richest people in Europe. All right? But I think it was primarily because they were hard workers, man. These guys, they would work sun up to sundown and tireless workers. Let's talk about, in fact, the modern idea of having a worth ethic comes from Calvinism. Mm. Even the concept of a work ethic is a Calvinist concept. So, were there Calvinist groups who sort of made a direct connection between prosperity and the blessing of God? Sure. But I don't think it's not, it wouldn't be like the prosperity gospel. I thought you were talking about the prosperity gospel.
No, yeah, that's a little different.
It's more like it's a sign of God's blessing, but it was not like if you be more committed, you'll have more money.
It was more of the sign of the fact that you were chosen.
Well, they would say that's why we're coming here and we're going to subjugate the Indians, we're going to subjugate the Malays, we're going to subjugate those blacks in Africa. We're the money, we're the blessed ones, manifest destiny. Yes, yes. If that's what you mean, definitely yes.
Mark, can you keep your deal on just for a minute longer? I'm sending my sermon in. Thank you, brother.
Yeah, my guy makes me turn my sermon in 3 days early. I'm telling you, I gotta change him around.
My guy wants to find a sermon video to match.
John, thank you.